Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Ernst Ruhl from Geisenheim. How are you, Ernst?
Pretty good. Thanks, Scott.
Excellent. You're one of the guys involved in vine breeding and all that sort of stuff, and professor of, what's your official title, Ernst?
Yeah, professor for grape breeding.
Great breeding, brilliant. But we were talking over lunch and you said that one of your passions or interests is rootstocks.
Yeah, that's true.
And you were saying that rootstocks, the ugly duckling of the vine breeding world.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. Rootstock breeding is a thing not a lot of people are doing. And you always hear, well, we got enough rootstocks. But as a matter of fact, about 95% of all the rootstocks in the world are less than 10 varieties.
Really?
So they're really cosmopolitans.
So there's obviously rootstocks quite an important thing. We did a podcast with a importer a wee while ago, and he was saying that there's two general types of rootstocks. You've got some roots that have got taps that go straight down, and then some that are just sort of flailing out on the side. Is that how you would categorize them?
Yeah, well, you have those two principal types. Yeah, some going deep down to be able to get water from deep down the ground.
Yeah.
Others are more shallow. So the first type would be the type you possibly find around the Mediterranean, where you have winter rain, soil profile is filled up with water during winter. And then it dries out during summer because no rain during summer.
Yeah.
So what you need is a tap root that goes 3, 4, 5 meters down and gets the last drop of water out.
Yep.
Here in Germany, we don't really need that because, well, we have most
rain
of the time,
all year round.
Most of the time rain once a week. So we don't really need it. A taproot system.
But when you talk to winemakers and that, they go, oh yeah, it's really important to make sure the roots go really deep to get all the nutrients and goodness from the soil.
Yeah, well, a certain percentage of the roots have to be deep just to survive drought spells. Yeah, you might have, even here, 4, 5, 6, 8 weeks, 10 weeks without rain, and then some of the roots have to be deep to get the water back out.
Something I don't understand is there's a lot of nutrients in the soil, but a lot of the nutrients that are accessible to the vine are near the surface, from what I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, limestone, you can't, the vines can't really get calcium out of limestone. It needs it to be almost in an organic matter anyway, in the humus.
Yeah.
So when winemakers are talking about, oh, yes, it's important to get your roots down to get all the flavor from the soils, how do you feel about that, being a rootstock guy?
Yeah, well, definitely mineral content and mineral nutrition has a lot to do with wine composition. But major two parts are, one is potassium, which is basically in balancing the acid in our wine and grape juice. And the other one, of course, is nitrogen. If a plant takes up more nitrogen, we will have bigger berries, we will have bigger fruit.
And wild leaf growth.
A lot of leaves, so we will have a big canopy. Most of the fruit will be inside the canopy, and because fruit is big, we will have less flavor, less light exposure, and so on.
Yep.
And I think in most cases, the rootstock effect really is a nitrogen effect. So if we have a vigorous rootstock, that's just like putting on more nitrogen. We're having a bigger canopy. We have bigger crops.
So the rootstock is just absorbing more nitrogen.
Yeah, it's not only that, but what's associated to rootstock effect has a lot to do with nitrogen uptake.
I suppose if the root has got a lot of its mass down below, it can get access to water, but it can't really get access to nitrogen because the nitrogen's near the surface.
If a root is going deep down, it will still have some roots up on the surface.
Yep.
But that deep root system may create some problems. For example, you go to California, a rootstock they use very often in California is a rootstock called 3309.
Okay. They do have great names. No wonder no one's interested
in
that.
Really, that's good for marketing. That's 3309. What rootstock are you using? 3309. Okay. This is a rootstock that's fairly shallow, fibrous root system, very close to the surface. So you think California, shallow roots, does it make sense? Yes, it makes sense because they're irrigating. And where's the water? The water is on the top.
Yep.
So irrigating them, why having roots deep down? And if you would have a rootstock with a deep rooting system, the result would be your water is on the top and the root is on the bottom.
Yeah.
So as an effect would be that a deep rooting rootstock would appear as a weak rootstock, as a less vigorous rootstock, because the root is not where the water is.
Okay, so in France and places like in Europe where you're not allowed to irrigate, the deeper rootstock is better.
Yeah. So people would not use a rootstock like 3309 in a drought situation, because if you don't have water, it doesn't make sense.
Okay, now that makes sense. So why do the people say that deep rootstocks are better?
The important thing is, if we really want to get the goodies into your berries, that's what's happening after the raisin. At that time, the plant really has to have enough water to basically have enough photosynthesis to produce sugar, to produce flavor, and so on. So if you have a root system that's too shallow, what will happen, particularly under Mediterranean conditions, is the water will just run out. So the plant will possibly just make it to the raisin, possibly a few more weeks, and then sort of it will just sit there and do nothing because it hasn't got water. So if you have a deep root system, the root would still be able to get water up to the top, even after the raisin, when the actual quality happens.
Again, just for the listeners, if they're not sure, the raisin is when the grapes change color.
Yeah, and get soft and start accumulating sugar and so on.
Because they're little hard, little green things, and then they change color, and then boosh, they blow up as well.
We're talking about pea size, and how they look.
Okay, so that makes sense. What about different types of rootstocks that are better for different conditions? You showed me a vine, Vinitus Ballandieri, and you said that was quite good for the limestone soils.
Yeah,
and you're saying that they're actually using the wrong type of rootstock in Europe.
The problem was, after phylloxera was introduced and people realized that they have to find a solution for it, idea came up pretty soon that we would need a genetic solution for it, which means, well, we either have to breed varieties that are altogether resistant to phylloxera, or that we would have to use rootstocks. And so the idea was to develop rootstocks. The problem is that in North America, where our rootstocks or their ancestors come from, we don't have much lime in the soil. So we have very acidic soils. And the problem those plants had when they were growing here, they turned yellow because it didn't take up any iron.
What was that called?
That's called lime-induced iron chlorosis.
Chlorosis. And you see that in Puifume.
In a lot of places.
Sancerre, yeah.
Yeah. And so they had to get species into their breeding program that were good to survive under limey conditions. Sorry. And the one species that's very good at that is Vitis ballandieri, which comes from central Texas. That's where there is a lot of limestone in a particular area. The problem was, when they started doing that, Texas was, well, pretty much unexplored.
Bit of a wild west, but like now, isn't it?
Really, yeah, it was. And so they actually only used just a handful of rootstock, well, of plants for the rootstock breeding in the whole of Europe. And that's something we want to tackle. That's why one of my colleagues actually went to Texas in 2004 and collected material there in the wild, because we think there is more in that species than just those five vines.
Okay, so you're getting a rootstock that's got an opportunity to really go survive well in limestone and hopefully be phylloxera resistant.
Yes, that's right. That's what we're after.
Fingers crossed, yeah. And do you think a vine that's suffering from chlorosis, I interviewed a winemaker quite a long ago from Ravenswood, Joel Peterson, and he said that, you know, sometimes the unusual flavors you get in wines is not because the wine's getting access to something. Sometimes unusual flavors is because it's having to adapt to missing something.
It might be the point.
Yeah, so maybe if you do solve the chlorosis problem, maybe the wine won't be as good, perhaps. I don't know. Is that a...
I don't think so, particularly not with Lyme and chlorosis, because the result of that, that's why you have yellow leaves, is they don't contain any chlorophyll. Chlorophyll is a stuff that actually makes the sugar.
Yeah.
So... well, without sugar, I wouldn't say that there is good wine.
Yeah, although a lot of people say, treat them mean, keep them keen.
what is definitely a point is that on limey ground, you have less uptake of potassium because of the competition between calcium and potassium in uptake. And potassium is the one that actually counterbalances your acids.
Yeah.
So if you go to a limey site, you will have less potassium and therefore you will have more acidity, which creates freshness. And so that is definitely one of the reasons why people prefer limey site.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I'd noticed two things with wines that have been from limestone. First of all, you're right that the acidity is just a bit sharper and cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
People say, so often describe it as minerality, but that's just a bad description, I think. And the second thing you get is you often find tannins are a bit harder. And that could be because...
Because of a different pH. The pH might be lower.
Yeah.
So your tannins... Well, that's definitely a point. That you the other thing is usually on limestone, usually your plants grow a bit weaker. So you have more an open canopy, therefore more light penetration. And light creates...
Polyphenols. Tannins.
Anthocyanins. So that might be a bit of both. That it's one thing might be a pH effect, and the other one could actually be also different influences.
Yeah, I notice that wines that are quite acidic, the tannins are always a bit more aware. You're more aware of them. I've always thought that's the reason why you don't generally grow a lot of wines on limestone, a lot of red grapes on white limestone. Mm. You grow a bit of Pinot, but Pinot doesn't have a lot of tannins in them.
Yeah.
Merlot, a wee bit in Saint-Emilion. But generally, people tend to grow white wines on limestone and red wines on everything else.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. That sort of explains it a bit more. I'm slowly working my way through these things.
So that, there's, of course, also growing particular variety on particular sites is also a lot of tradition about it.
Yeah, do you think?
Yeah, sure. Hey,
for me, there's two things with soils. It's the ability of the ground to hold water and the ability of the ground to pass water. So if you're in a wet place, you don't want to be growing wine on clay soils because that holds water. And if you're in a wet place, you want to be on limestone because it passes water, but it still holds a bit. So what do you think about the influence of soils on the vine apart for flavor?
Yeah, I think a lot of soil influence has to do with physical conditions of the soil. So people are talking about, well, a stony soil is a warmer soil because the stones warm up during the day.
Yeah.
Well, actually, what keeps temperature a lot better is water. So it's not the stones that keep up the warmth, it's actually the water. But
the stones don't have
gravelly soils. Gravelly soils are warmer because of the stones, because they pass the water through. Therefore, it's warmer.
Let me get... So if you've got water close to the surface...
Yes, then they are cold, but they stay warm during the night.
No, I'm confused here. Let's just start that again. This is quite interesting. I've never heard this before. So I've got a clay soil with a bit of water there.
Yep.
So water heats up slower and then releases the heat overnight.
Yes.
It's a bit like being near the coast. You know, in your coast, it's cooler during the day, but warmer at night.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and stony soils don't have the water, so heat up faster during the day.
And cool down during the night.
But normally people say that they cool down slower overnight, a bit like a night store heater, you know, where you heat bricks up during the day.
But still, stones don't really store that much of water. Is really the way to store heat.
Not stones. So what about in Mosul, where you got the hillside and there's a lot of stones there, and they sort of say that
they say that. Well, of course, what happens there, you have a lot of air movement.
Yeah.
So the cold air can actually flow away into the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And also the other thing is, cold nights are not bad because they keep the acid.
Yeah.
So it sort of makes sense. When you realize that a a warm site is a warm site, it's particularly in spring, because the soil warms up a lot faster on a gravelly site with all the stones in there. So you have an earlier bud burst, you have an earlier earlier flowering, an earlier veraison. And so the plant just gets ahead of a plant that grows on a particular wet site nearby.
Oh, okay. So it's not necessarily the releasing of the warmth at night. It's the fact that you start the process a bit earlier.
Yeah, so it just gives you a longer growing season. There is a lot to that. It's definitely not one answer.
Yeah, no, that's right. But I hadn't really thought about it being the moisture in the soil is the main
and
thing.
Plus, particularly in the Mosel region, if you have 50% stones, you have 50% less water. So that means that your plants always have a mild water stress. Even if it's has just been raining, there's no excess amount of water. And that creates smaller berries.
Yep.
Smaller berries have more flavor. And so that's another reason why you're getting a better fruit quality. While you go to a loamy site, well, big berries and, well, a lot of water in the berry.
I imagine your lead times are 10, 20 years to commercialization.
With rootstocks? Well, you're talking 30, 40, 50 years before you come to close to that. Okay, so it takes a long, long
time. You've been in the business now, 20 years at Geisenheim. So where do you think things will be at your retirement, looking at you another 30 years away?
Definitely not.
My wife tells me to be polite and charming.
Well, the thing really with rootstock breeding is that basically it needs 2-3 generations. So my predecessor, he released a variety pretty close to his retirement, and that was bred 50 years earlier.
Really, yeah.
When a guy that actually bred it was close to retirement. So that's basically part of the deal, that it takes 2 or 3 generations to do that. But nevertheless, if we don't do it, we will not have it.
Yeah,
and that's also the reason why that is definitely that is government thing. No one will invest into something that possibly pays off in 50 years.
Is that the same with normal vine breeding as well, or
with wine crepe sign breeding? Yes, that's pretty much a thing of state research institutes. With table grapes, it's a different thing, because with table grapes you can actually see your final product pretty soon. Yeah, so from doing a cross and seeing your grape for the first time and tasting it is less than 2 years.
What's that, table grapes?
Well, the final product is your grape.
Yeah.
The final product with wine, grapes, is the wine. And you need just a certain volume to produce it. You can make wine from a single bunch, but it doesn't taste like a wine that's been in a 500-liter barrel.
Oh, really? I did not know that. I've never done... Well, I suppose...
We're getting close to that, but it's not one-to-one. While having just one bunch of a table grape, you can taste it and you see, is it seeded or not? Big berries, small berries, flavor, no flavor. Yeah, you still might have to do a bit more research to know how well the bunch stores, which is a big issue with table grapes. But key things are very easy to...
That's why you're saying that the Americans getting involved in table grape industry, you see returns very quickly, whereas your stuff is long, slow.
It's long term. Plus, wine grapes are very traditional.
Yeah.
Well, Pinot Noir, 2,000 years. Riesling, 500 years.
Yeah. I asked the question, where do you think things will be in 30, 40, 50 years?
I'm pretty sure we will see more rootstocks. I think also our knowledge about rootstock will be increased. I think we will see more site-adapted clones in production, so we will know, okay, this is a particular good clone for that particular site.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we will also see is some genetically modified plants in the field. Sure, it has to happen. I think at the moment it's quite a curious situation that people think GMOs are bad. On the other hand, they also don't want to have sprays being used. And so we cannot have healthy grapes without protection. We either have to do it genetically, by breeding, or by introducing genes in a GMO type way, or we have to spray. Yeah, and so I think at the moment the public sort of doesn't want to realize that. So I have the feeling that people think if we don't do anything, everything is fine, which is not the case. We have to do something in the vineyard to protect our grapes against diseases and against pests. We can do it biologically, by breeding, or by GMOs, or we can do it chemically.
But if you've got a 50-year cycle just for a normal breeding program,
yeah,
imagine how long it's going to be for GMO.
Well, GMOs could be faster. So that could happen in 10, 15, 20 years. You will still have to evaluate them. You will still have to make sure that the gene works and the gene only does what it's meant to be and not causes off flavors and things like that. But you don't have to evaluate the plant in a normal way. So therefore, the cycle would be shorter than doing it in a traditional way.
Okay, then, Ernst. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris.